Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour coming your way from KBOO Portland. That music you are listening to is called On Strike UAW by G-Mac Cash. I'm going to come back to the auto strike in a moment, but first, I want to announce that we have just begun our fall membership drive. KBOO hopes to raise $55,000 to keep the radio station on the air. Our theme is Fresh Off the Vine. Every week, the moles pluck the fresh fruit of views, reviews, and interviews on issues that you, our listeners, care about. If you like what you hear, please support your community radio station. You can go to kboo.fm/give or simply text KBOO to 44321. September is back to school month. Today on our show, we're going to bring you a couple of commentaries. Sharon Grant will take up the issue of gun violence that plagues our schools, and Fran Michelle will examine how the worst crises of our time, especially the epidemic of hate, present special challenges to kids and teachers. Following that, Jan Hawkins speaks with two lawyers about legal strategies for climate justice and how the courts won't save us. We'll close our show with a book review by Larry Bolden on Lisa See's historical novel, Lady Tan's Circle of Women, about women healers in 15th century China. But first, let's talk labor. This has been and continues to be a stunning year for labor actions. Workers are a long way from winning their full share of the pie, but remarkable gains have been made. According to the Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, more than 320,000 workers have participated in at least 230 strikes so far this year. Our music today is all about unions and strikes. In support of UAW strikers, Mole Matt Witt offers up this simple verse entitled Car Parts.
I did a simple internet search for the major parts of a car, and Google said the answer is chassis, engine, transmission system, car body, steering system, and braking system. But it left out each worker's hands, arms, back, knees, ears, nerves, and lungs. Another search found that auto workers suffer injuries and illnesses at more than twice the rate of other private industry. Maybe next I will search, what is the true cost of a car? Who pays the price? And who gets the profits?
Thanks, Matt, for that homage to auto workers. In Oregon, you can support UAW members at the Chrysler Parts Distribution Center in Beaverton by joining them out on the picket line. More at #StandUp. Let's turn now to kids, teachers, and schools. Right-wing gun lovers are doubling down on their push to arm teachers. But as it turns out, armed personnel in schools only augment violence against kids. Our well-read Red, Sharon Grant, reads excerpts from an article by award-winning teacher Natalia Berginsky, which was originally published on June 7, 2022 in These Times.
This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. A new school year has begun across the country. What better time for me to be reading from the article, In the Wake of Uvalde, A Teacher's Plea for Police-Free Schools, by Natalia Braginsky, found in the fall 2022 of Rethinking Schools. And it starts. For educators like myself, no matter how far we teach from Uvalde, Texas, the mass shooting at Robb Elementary, like so many before it, is still palpable in our classrooms among students and teachers alike. In this new school year, as we yet again ask what should be done, students and teachers who sit at the center of this crisis as its primary victims must be decision makers at the forefront of any societal response. Instead, this shooting has prompted renewed calls by national Republican lawmakers to arm teachers. 28 states already allow staff to carry guns in schools. And since the Uvalde shooting, some are trying to make it even easier. In Ohio, where I grew up and attended public school, Republican lawmakers have fast-tracked approval of a bill that not only allows teachers to be armed, but also reduces the required training for carrying a gun in school from 737 hours to just 24 hours. These calls to arm educators come despite vehement opposition by my union, the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, and the largest teachers union in the country, the National Education Association, or the NEA. Like fellow educators responding to the Uvalde school shooting, I agree that now is the time for us to double down on calls for comprehensive gun reform, but that is not enough. Now is also the time for us to stand in solidarity with our students in the fight for police-free schools. Critics may say it's the wrong time to take such action, but this is the exact moment to renew the demand for care, not cops. Previous high-profile school shootings have led to drastic increases in armed police in the public schools. A 2020 report from the Education Policy Research Center at the University of Florida found that in response to the 2018 Parkland school shooting, the number of cops in Florida schools nearly doubled. National studies have shown that the presence of police in schools leads to 3.5 times more arrests of youth, and in some states, as high as 8 times more arrests. This approach criminalizes students for normal adolescent behavior, and these arrests disproportionately target Black students and students with disabilities, both of whom are 3 times more likely to be arrested by school police than their white and non-disabled counterparts. What's more, many of these schools hire cops at the expense of counselors, nurses, school psychologists, and social workers, the very people who could play a crucial role in preventing school shootings and supporting students through the many traumatic crises they are facing. Uvalde spends approximately 40% of its city budget on police, and the school district has its own 6-officer police department. By now, we have all heard that police were inside Robb Elementary minutes after the gunman entered, yet they failed to stop him. Outside, even more police handcuffed and pepper-sprayed parents who attempted to make their way into the school to save their children. The fact that police do not protect young people, even during a mass shooting, is damning enough. But the full truth is even worse. A 2021 study conducted by violence researcher Jillian Peterson examined the past nearly 40 years of school shootings and found that, quote, the rate of deaths was 2.83 times greater in schools with an armed guard present, unquote. This finding suggests that police presence does not prevent violence. Instead, it potentially makes school shootings nearly 3 times more deadly. Quote, an armed officer on the scene was the number one factor associated with increased casualties after the perpetrator's use of assault rifles or submachine guns, end quote, the study concluded. Young people, especially youth of color, have resisted these illusions of safety and have envisioned and fought for alternatives. As one student said, quote, we protect ourselves better than the police do, end quote. They added, quote, the students of New Haven have said, we don't want police in our schools, end quote. Young people in New Haven and across the country have long been leading this struggle for police-free schools. In June 2020, Many educators joined that fight, rallying for the removal of police from their schools and for investment in mental health supports. Since then, according to Education Week, quote, 49 districts serving about 2 million children have ended their school policing programs or cut their budgets, end quote. This is but a small fraction of all the school districts in the country, but it is a start. Teachers now have a critical choice to make, one laid out at a recent panel of high school organizers, co-hosted by the Anti-Racist Teaching and Learning Collective and the Zen Education Project. This panel brought together 12 high schoolers from across the country to discuss their organizing in response to the crises of our time. As Caitlin Savato, a Chicago public school student, put it, quote, teachers are either abolitionists or they're police, end quote. In the wake of yet another school shooting, calls to arm teachers are attempting to enlist us as police. But the answer to this moment isn't becoming cops, and neither is it welcoming more cops into our schools. This moment, which we know will befall us again, calls for reimagining what true safety means and working with our students to make that a reality. This moment, with all its grief and loss, calls on U.S. teachers to march alongside our students in the movement for police-free schools. This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I just read excerpts from the article, In the Wake of Uvalde, A Teacher's Plea for Police-Free Schools, by Natalia Briginsky, found in the fall 2022 edition of Rethinking Schools.
Sony Pictures, Disney Plus, Amazon, Warner Bros., Universal, Apple TV, Paramount, and more. Writers on strike, existential, walking the line, picket schedule, marching orders, a new deal that we will not stand for. Mini rooms, income, weekly pay, minimums, layoffs, oh no, yeah, big raises for CEOs, no residual streaming, 2% we're screaming.
That was a clip from the WGA Strike Song by Derica Furman. The work stoppage by the Writers Guild of America and joined by the Screen Actors Guild is entering its 6th month. Before that, Sharon Grant read from an article by teacher Natalia Briginsky, published on June 7, 2022, in These Times. A link to the full article can be found on the webpage for this segment at kboo.fm. The article can also be found at Rethinking Schools. Now we turn to more back-to-school commentary. Fran Michel surveys the landscape of challenges to school kids and finds that the solutions, as always, lie in solidarity, democracy, and organizing. Here's Fran.
Schools can be great places, not only providing opportunities for learning and discovery and growth, with gifted and dedicated teachers and chances for students to form relationships with each other across all sorts of differences of culture and background, but also offering hubs for material resources like food and healthcare. Public schools, especially with unionized teachers, can help create broader community connections and foster egalitarian civic virtues. But schools can also be dangerous places, and I'm not even going to go into the danger of gun violence, addressed by Sharon Grant in this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour. Schools are, of course, not isolated from the wider social problems of violence and policing, of economic inequality and precarity, of climate collapse, or of the continuing pandemic. They're an arena of struggle over the kind of world we want. Public education is under attack, with legislative assaults on accurate teaching of racial history in the U.S., on the dignity and rights of queer people, and on teacher autonomy. Oregon has been spared some of this trouble. The state still requires a diverse social studies curriculum and has not gone the way of Florida, Oklahoma, Texas, or other states that are banning books or adopting curriculum from PragerU. Despite its misleading name, Prager is not an accredited university, but a right-wing foundation with funding from a long list of right-wing allies. Their purportedly educational videos include shorts comparing climate change denialism to the Warsaw Uprising against the Nazis, a cartoon Frederick Douglass praising the Founding Fathers and calling the Constitution a glorious liberty document, and a video advising young women to make themselves pretty, embrace the idea of being a wife and mother, and try smiling. Meanwhile, 17 states have new anti-LGBTQ education laws, including rules banning trans students from playing on teams or using bathrooms that align with their gender identity, requiring pronouns to align with sex assigned at birth, or restricting classroom discussion of LGBT issues or sex education. Even without or beyond such laws, the effect has been chilling, with teachers worried about sanctions from administrators and complaints from parents. And certainly queer and non-binary students and students of color have felt the effects of this movement in hate speech and harassment. In Oregon, none of the anti-LGBTQ measures proposed in the state legislature this year have succeeded, so young people can still hope that teachers will respect their identities and provide them an accurate version of history. Anecdotal reports suggest that more people are moving to Oregon to escape states where over 80 new anti-LGBTQ plus laws have passed, not only affecting education, but also blocking funding for gender-affirming care and limiting people from updating gender information on IDs and records. But of course, that doesn't mean everyone in Oregon or at schools is queer positive and anti-racist, or that kids and teachers won't be harassed, bullied, or otherwise harmed. The Oregon Department of Education has a student success plan for students who are lesbian, gay, transgender, non-binary, queer, questioning, two-spirit, intersex, asexual, and those with myriad other gender identities and sexual orientations, though the 2020 policy review acknowledges that implementation of current anti-discrimination and anti-bullying policies on their own do not create safe and affirming school spaces for LGBTQ2SIA plus students. That inclusive curriculum needs to be expanded and integrated into other initiatives, and that state guidance on these issues may not be well known among educators. Educators will presumably be made aware of a new state law that did pass, requiring high school students to take a half credit in financial literacy, though they may not learn that, as reported in Rethinking Schools, such curricula tend to rest on the neoclassical economic paradigm that centers individual choices in the market and often ultimately blame individuals for systemic problems, reinforcing an assumption that our capitalist political economy is a meritocracy, and that people exploited and oppressed must have a deficit of knowledge, intelligence, morality, or discipline, as if people become millionaires by skipping lattes to invest in stocks. The capitalist interests promoting so-called financial literacy share some ground with those promoting panic about American history and about the complexity of gender and sexuality, not to mention those promoting denial of climate crisis and the ongoing pandemic. Sinclair Broadcasting, the right-wing conglomerate that owns hundreds of television stations around the United States, has a national K-12 education franchise called Crisis in the Classroom, airing on 73 local news stations, including Portland's KATU, helping to foster concern about wokeness and to promote school vouchers that undermine funding for public schools. But according to a recent commentary from the Brookings Institution, it's not true that COVID-19 led to a mass exodus from public schools. Despite what you may have read in the New York Times, there was little impact on public school enrollments, and polls showed most families were satisfied with how public schools handled the pandemic. Families in some Oregon school districts might be a little less happy now, since Portland Public Schools and the Beaverton School District are both using new guidelines from the Oregon Health Authority over those recommended by the CDC. This means students can now go to school if they test positive for COVID but are asymptomatic. CDC guidelines still recommend that people stay home and isolate for at least 5 days after testing positive, and that people continue to wear a mask for another 5 days. But since the new guidelines mean that students who are actively infectious can now exhale freely into the air shared by their classmates and teachers, we can expect more cases of COVID. And since repeat cases, even asymptomatic or mild cases, increase the risk of bodily damage and long COVID, we can expect more illness and early death. Many Oregon schools have been provided with new HEPA air filters through a federal program, but the filters have reportedly not always been distributed to classrooms, or when they are in classrooms, they've not always been turned on. Here's a tip to parents, teachers, and students. Actually running a HEPA air filter and wearing a close-fitting, high-filtration mask both reduce your risk of contracting COVID. The decision to bring even infectious kids back to the classroom may result from the U.S. Department of Education's concern about declining attendance, and perhaps the grant funding made available for increasing attendance. The U.S. DOE acknowledges that student attendance is significantly impacted by things like students' physical and mental health and housing instability, though unfortunately this doesn't seem to be leading to federal support for wearing respirator masks or for guaranteed secure housing. As for young people's mental health, the value of activism as an antidote to climate-related anxiety suggests they might benefit more from participating in a youth climate strike than from attending another school day. With respect to the pandemic, although illness, death, and the loss of caregivers are obviously traumatic and have disproportionately impacted Black and Brown communities, some studies have shown that remote schooling improved adolescent mental health, with reductions in suicide attempts, self-harm, and overdoses, perhaps because they were freed from the harassment and bullying they faced at school. So when the Portland Public Schools HR director worries about learning loss, comparing the effect of a potential teacher strike to the effect of the pandemic, it's worth pausing to consider what's involved. Portland teachers have been working almost a year without a contract, and bargaining with the district reached an impasse earlier this month. Teachers need compensation adequate to afford stable housing for themselves. They need time to prepare their lessons and respond to student work, and since years of research demonstrate that kids learn better in classes about half the size they are in some Portland schools, students need smaller class sizes. As Kianga Yamada Taylor has noted, a real plan for recovery from the devastation of the pandemic in public education can be found in the strikes initiated by teachers and their unions. Their demands for smaller class sizes, better conditions within school buildings, more resources to attend to students' mental health, and higher pay for teachers and teacher assistants have created a map for how to boost learning achievement. The Chicago Teachers Union won gains in 2019 with their model of bargaining for the public good. And that dedication to community solidarity across all our issues and all our crises exemplifies some of the promise and power of public education in our work together for a better world. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
That was Fran Michel on Our Schools in Crisis. The full text of her commentary will be published on the webpage for this segment at kboo.fm and includes the links to all of Fran's sources. Did you know that KBOO gets 80% of its operating funds from listeners like you? That means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship, which means that you'll hear programming on KBOO like The Old Mole that you will never hear on commercial radio. Please lend us a hand by becoming a member or, if you are already a member, increasing your monthly donation. You can do all that by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or clicking on Donate in your KBOO mobile app. Thanks to all our listeners who have donated in the past. The long fight against Enbridge's oil pipeline, known as Line 3 in Minnesota, brought down the heavy hand of state repression on climate activists. Over 1,000 wound up in the court to fight criminal charges. In part two of her interview with Claire Glenn and Kira Kelly, attorneys with the Climate Defense Project, Jan Hocken explores the promise of legal strategies for climate justice and the perils of seeking justice in a court system rigged to serve the interests of racial capitalism. Part one of this interview aired last week on September 18 and can be found on our webpage at kboo.fm. Here's Jan.
I wanted to also talk with both of you about the necessity defense as a legal strategy. You know, there were the four Catholic workers, valve turners we followed, including one in Minnesota. And, you know, it's a long road, a long rocky road to pursue those cases. And the costs are high on many levels. But there's been a lot of community support around those cases. And yet it does involve claiming innocence by way of the necessity and meeting the criteria that are established by the courts. Of course, one of them is the emphasis on nonviolent actions, a history of exhausting alternatives. And you have to present a portrait of pretty extreme virtue to prevail at all in these cases. And yet they've been really important in bringing the logic of justice into these criminal cases. A lot of people understand very quickly kind of the face validity of a necessity defense. It has a beautiful logic to it. Kira, can you start by commenting on where we are with the use of the necessity defense? And then Claire, I'd like your thoughts as well.
Well, this might be blasphemy for somebody employed by the Climate Defense Project, but I actually try as hard as I possibly can to talk my clients out of raising the necessity defense at every opportunity. I have attempted to raise it unsuccessfully in a couple of cases in a couple different jurisdictions, including for some clients who were arrested as part of the No Coal, No Gas movement to shut down the last major coal-fired power plant in New England, in Merrimack, New Hampshire. Also unsuccessfully attempted to raise it in Clearwater County, Minnesota, for a water protector who was charged with obstructing legal process, holding onto the fence outside a pump station. The majority of the time, what happens is, at least in my personal experience, you tell the judge that you want to raise it. They say, what are you talking about? You file an extensive memorandum. And then they say, nope, you're not allowed to raise it. And then at trial subsequently, they are even more aware and averse to any kind of moral arguments coming in. And the prosecutor often repeats, you're just trying to get around the necessity defense. So they actually get stricter on the standard of relevance when you've tried and failed in the same proceeding previously to fight for your right to raise the necessity defense. And relevance, excuse my legalese, it's the standard for when evidence can come in. Evidence has to be relevant to the issues of a case in order to be presented at trial.
I wanted to just respond to your points. I think it's not blasphemy. It's reality that these are very difficult cases, admittedly. But what I felt was not part of the coverage of the valve turner cases that I wanted to draw out in the first necessity film was the brilliance of the strategy itself and the scope of it and how the organizing community mobilization around a coordinated four-state action spread across four states, cutting off valves to bringing tar sands into the U.S. There were communities all along those four states involved. They did community events in organizing around. That's how I learned about it here in Portland. So I think it's to have a fair test of it, you would have to look at it as a broader coordinated grassroots strategy rather than just one person locking themselves down and then trying it out in court. I don't mean to dismiss that, but I think the level of organization around these cases, even the one here in Portland, it was phenomenal. You know, what was involved and people being out there in the street supporting it. Claire, you have any thoughts on that, the strategy?
Yeah, you know, I will say first that I do believe in a diversity of tactics, that is how we make our movements stronger. But beyond that, I will say that I personally very strongly believe that the best we can do in the courts is harm reduction. And unfortunately, we often have this glorification of court cases as an avenue for change. And that is simply false. For example, Brown v. Board of Education, decided in 1954, is often heralded as this amazing case that resulted in integration of schools. But schools were not integrated for a decade until 1964 and the Civil Rights Act and the feds getting involved and people seeing what was happening in the South on television and all of the organizing that was happening behind all of that. And so while court cases can sometimes be an avenue for organizing, they can be a locus for organizing. And as you've said, there are certainly examples of people using a court case to do the organizing work outside. I think that it's important to note that the change never happens inside the courtroom. The change is happening because of the organizing that's happening outside. And I think that we actually do ourselves a disservice when we limit our organizing and the creativity with which we approach organizing to organizing solely around court cases, particularly criminal court cases.
But isn't that what it means to be a movement lawyer? Kira, if you want to comment.
Yes, I would love to. I think that what you're saying is completely true about organizing always amplifying a message, and that relationship building and coordination is always a good way to make whatever you're doing more impactful and stronger, and to put that message out there. I think with the necessity defense in particular, the bottom line question is, what narrative are you amplifying? And is that a narrative that we as movement-minded people, regardless of whether or not we're lawyers, should be staying behind? So thinking about the necessity defense as exactly what you named it as, it's a framework for saying this group of people are innocent. And the innocence framework in and of itself is violent. The innocence framework in and of itself tries to create, again, a false dichotomy of people who are pure, perfect victims, good, and people who are bad, disposable, evil criminals. And that framework in and of itself is something we should be saying, no, we're not going to play into that. We're not going to participate in that. Rather than saying, let's keep these people outside of the category of criminal, we should challenge criminality as a concept, as a tool of the settler colonial racial capitalist state of positing certain categories of people as bad and disposable.
Even if you didn't go that far and stayed with the violent, nonviolent distinction, which has been a topic of endless debate, certainly throughout my lifetime as a politically conscious person, is that part of what you're describing here? Is it does rest on even some of the technical criteria for establishing what it means to be nonviolent, like is a property crime violent? Is that part of what you're suggesting here, that it accepts the premise that any form of violence is criminal?
I don't think that it's about violence or nonviolence. I think it's about the fact that the police and prison industrial complex and the courts that provide them the platform to continue to exist and to justify their existence through running people through it and locking them up, that those systems are violent. And that when we voluntarily engage in the court system and expect justice to come out of it, we're legitimizing that system and the violence it promotes. And it's not about putting on our fanciest suit and playing this fundamentally biased game as best as we can. It's about talking to each other, having conversations without the limits that the court, through rules such as relevancy, puts on the conversations we're trying to have, but instead having conversations outside of the courtroom without those limits about what is causing harm, what does safety and security look like, and how can we build a better world together, rather than asking the courts for a tiny scrap of legitimacy that inherently reinforces their role as the decider of right and wrong in the first place, when we actually know that that system really only exists and has only ever existed to protect rich, white, wealthy people's ability to concentrate property and a monopoly on state violence.
But of course, you're having to advise people who engage in what the state determines to be illegal acts. And a lot of the history of civil disobedience as a legal strategy is to draw out the violence of the state, to expose it through putting that violence onto the state. There's always this dilemma, though, of how you engage in actions that are going to invite the brutal repression of the state. Claire, what are your thoughts?
I think that there's a difference between drawing out the violent hypocrisies of the state and taking that a step further and saying that the answer to those harms and violences is to actually give the system an opportunity to correct itself and maintain its legitimacy, rather than pushing for something bigger that recognizes the power always inherently remains with the people. you know, you had mentioned the role of movement lawyers. I think that there are many movement lawyers who put on a suit and believe that they are the leaders of the cause for justice with a capital J. And I think that those movement lawyers do so much harm because they are the movement lawyers who are convincing their clients that the movement lawyer is the key to success and the courts are the avenue to get there. And I think that the best lawyers are the ones who recognize that we would rather be doing something else too. I would love to organize myself out of a job. I would love for not only activists, but people of color, low-income communities, to no longer be policed to such an extent that lawyers like myself and Kira are needed en masse to try to protect people from this crushing grind of the criminal system.
Like emergency room doctors who have a very big role to play in our healthcare system.
Right. You'd rather that we have a healthcare system where people are able to access primary care so that they're not needing the ER doctors in the first place. And I will also say too, you know, one of the best organizers that I know and one of my very dear friends is in prison. And he has been doing amazing, amazing organizing work in prison. But at the end of the day, he will put anyone who wants to glorify prison right in their place, because the prison system is doing everything that it possibly can to undermine his organizing. And they have so much more power to do it when you're on the inside. And he will tell anyone who will listen to him, don't put yourself in a position where you're voluntarily going to prison. You're going to be able to achieve so much more, whatever your organizing goals are, if you're on the outside.
This is Patricia Kohlberg, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm interrupting our interview to remind our listeners that if you are not a member of KBOO, now's a good time during our fall fundraising drive to sign up and become a monthly contributor. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio for free and given voice to many of the diverse communities in the Portland area. Please help keep that fresh fruit of music and news and commentary coming off the vine of community radio. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or click on donate in your KBOO mobile app. Now, back to Jan Hawken with Claire Glenn and Kira Kelly.
And then thinking about legal strategies in going forward, I'd like to have some of each of your thoughts on the terrain ahead. We're celebrating, of course, this week that the judge's ruling for the Montana youth case, and a lot of hopes and promises are on that front. Also caveats about what can be expected from a successful ruling. What would you both say about the legal strategies and this diversity of tactics that you both have emphasized in closing today? I know part of what you're saying is stay out of the court system as much as you can, but of course, being an activist, particularly involved in radical tactics, confrontational tactics, does mean entering the court system. And also, you both emphasize speaking to the community where you live and understanding what your action is communicating, what is the story you're trying to tell, and who's the audience. Kira, do you have closing thoughts?
Sure. As far as legal strategies go, I think that the best legal strategy would be to act preventatively so that you're not stuck in the coercive situation of trying to come up with a legal strategy in the first place. And I see that being accomplished by working on three things. The first being political education. So developing a theory of change, figuring out how to get from the world we're in to the world we want, understanding the court system, not only intellectually, but internalizing it in our hearts as a place where we are set up to lose every time we go there, and we shouldn't be voluntarily escalating our engagement with the courts expecting justice to come out of it. I think, like Claire was saying, for me, the internalization of that learning has come from deep, intimate friendships with people who are not choosing to go to prison, but who are stuck there. So I noticed that a lot of my clients who are choosing to risk arrest, in particular, white college-educated clients, don't have close family or friends who are incarcerated. They are the example for their community of what the court system is like, rather than going to court with an internalized understanding of how violent it is. And I think that needs to change. So political education, building connections with communities who are already criminalized and not by their choice. The second thing I think is trauma healing. I think that we get ourselves in a lot more legal trouble than we need to be because we're not taking care of ourselves. And I'm guilty of that too. Like I notice myself doing cop watching and losing a little control and putting myself or friends and comrades at legal risk because I'm scared and I haven't done the work to really make sure I'm in the movement, like as the best healed, most healed person I can be, rather than using the movement as a proxy for healing. I think that a lot of us are seeking notoriety or seeking
there's some, you know, drama
a
there.
Moment of yeah. There's drama, totally. Yeah, there's a lot of us are working against each other because we're people living in a really violent culture and we're all a little bit broken and we're making it harder than it needs to be, rather than trying to build something like nurturance culture where we're actually like, nobody needs to prove their worth by getting arrested or making themselves into a martyr. So doing that trauma healing really means that we can not have to get arrested because we're just a little bit able to take a deep breath and act more intentionally. And I think that the third thing, which is related to the other two, is just relationship building, and that we're not going to be in as much of harm's way when we have the kinds of deep care-based relationships where we can give each other feedback on strategies, where we can say, hey, we don't need to do that, or hey, this is how we could be acting differently or better towards each other, whether that's talking about a legal strategy, encouraging our buddies to take that sweetheart plea deal, and or encouraging people to do more effective, more powerful movement building actions that don't involve raising the necessity defense, for example. I'll just leave it at that.
As some of what you're describing has been also more associated with feminist practices, the shadow labor of movements, work that's less apt to be lionized or cast in heroic terms, that is more of women's work historically in movements. Claire, your final thoughts.
I think my final thoughts are to resist the silo, whether it's the criminal system, whether it is ego, whether it is martyrdom, whether it's lawyers who want to have their name in a headline. All of that is antithetical to the broader goal. You know, we're not saying that there aren't people who end up in the criminal system for a variety of reasons that you have to, you know, plead out at any cost. I certainly don't want listeners to have that takeaway. Because I also think that there are many, many ways to be subversive when you are caught within the criminal system's jaws.
No simple formula for this.
Right, exactly. It's very complicated, but it becomes less complicated when you have strong community that is able to help guide your goals and help connect you to broader community goals and movement goals. And one of the most powerful anecdotes that I have about this, you know, as a new public defender to this role, I had a group of co-defendants that I was representing all of them. And that in itself was very scary to me because public defenders, you know, we follow ethics in that we never represent co-defendants. And then this group of clients kept asking me, you know, how are you going to achieve our goals? And I'll say, well, what is your goal? And they would say, our goal is solidarity. And I would say, well, I don't know what that means, but we can work it out. And we had conversations about what solidarity means and what solidarity looks like. And this group of defendants actually had quite a diversity of risks, right? You had people who were in much more dangerous situations because they were charged with felonies. You had people in much more dangerous situations because of their identities, because they were people of color, because they were trans or gender nonconformist, and that would subject them to much more violence in the system if they were convicted. You had young people where a more serious conviction would really impact their ability to, you know, earn a living, et cetera, achieve whatever goals they have for their future. And then on the other hand, I had clients who had a much lower risk in this group, who were retirees, who didn't really care what was on their record, who were faced with misdemeanors, who were white didn't have the vulnerabilities that other people in the group had. And this group said, you know what? We are going to stand together and demand that none of us are going to accept this sweetheart plea deal until it is extended to all of us. Because the prosecutors were singling out the most vulnerable people. They were not being extended sweetheart deals in the same way that, you know, cis white retired men with no criminal record were being offered. And everyone banded together and said, none of us accepts the deal unless all of us get offered the deal. And it took months of posturing and negotiating and making very clear to the prosecutor that they were going to have to go through 20 trials one by one by one if they didn't extend this sweetheart offer to everyone. And ultimately, the prosecutor caved. And it was an immense success. And it had nothing to do with my litigation skills. And it had everything to do with the solidarity of defendants who refused to be siloed and demanded to remain in community with each other. And that is how I think we have success, whether we're in the criminal legal system or not.
It's a wonderful story. Actually, in the First Necessity film, Tara Houska describes a similar story of defendant solidarity that was critical, anything from an Indigenous perspective to what it really means to be a white ally in a movement where Indigenous people were suffered the most brutal repression. Well, in closing, is there a way that listeners can support the work there? What would you tell listeners about how they can support this work?
I would say one of the most important things that people can do that is relatively accessible is to just get informed about what's happening in your own backyard. What are the organizing fights that are happening and what's happening in the court system? Oftentimes, court watchers are like neocons who are watching court to make sure that, you know, so-called criminals are being sanctioned harshly. But we've actually in recent years seen this beautiful organizing work around liberatory court watching of people who are watching court to hold judicial actors accountable, law enforcement, prosecutors. And as people become increasingly aware of how unfair and unjust the system is, I encourage you to go to your local courthouse and ask where criminal court is happening and sit down for a few hours or a few days and just see, because it doesn't take long to see that things are wrong. And then talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, get other people involved and see what kind of organizing work you can do to make things better.
Hira, anything you'd like to add to that call?
I would agree with everything Claire said, and in particular, appreciate the emphasis on doing court watch for people who didn't choose to get arrested. We really don't need to like go to court for the purpose of having an educational experience when there are people already in court whose own coercive experience could be made better through accompaniment. So we can get prison pen pals if you want a prison pen pal. Some friends and I run a collective, Letter by Letter Vermont, New Hampshire. We have a blog. You can Google us. Happy to match you with somebody and read up on abolitionist organizing. Miriam Kaba, Angela Davis, Ruth Wilson Gilmore are all fantastic authors to learn from and to really try to practice that in our communities, in our personal relationships, and prefigure the world we're trying to live in totally outside and unrelated to the courtroom.
So you have a very intersectional analysis of climate justice movement as part of a broader racial justice movement and abolitionist movement as well. Thank you so much for being with us today, Claire Glenn and Kira Kelly. I hope to have you on the show again. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Nobody said it would be easy. Nobody said that it would all be fine, but together
That was Tom Morella with his song Hold the Line. Before that, you heard part two of Jan Hawkins' discussion with attorneys Claire Glenn and Kira Kelly with the Climate Defense Project about what we can and can't expect in terms of climate justice from the courts. To close our show today, bookmole Larry Bolden reviews a fascinating and lovely story about women taking care of women, particularly midwives assisting pregnant mothers in China during the 15th century. The novel by Lisa C. is called Lady Tan's Circle of Women. As usual, I will read Larry's review for him. This story begins in 1469, in the fifth year of the Qinghua Emperor's reign, when Tan Yongxiun was 8 years old. So begins Lisa C.'s superb account of Chinese medicine in the 15th century. On one level, it is a simple story of a girl, Tan, who wants to become a doctor and is tutored by her grandparents, who are both doctors. Her best friend, Mei Ling, is in training to be a midwife, and the two girls pursue their dreams under the kind but demanding eyes of Tan's grandparents. The book is worth reading just for this simple and lovely story, but C's real intent is to talk about Chinese medicine and especially male Chinese doctors. Says Tan's grandfather, quote, Confucius made clear that any profession in which blood is involved is considered below us. A midwife's contact with blood places her in the same base level as a butcher. Furthermore, midwives are disreputable. They are too much in the world. Perhaps, grandmother sighs, but since we physicians acknowledge blood is corrupt and corrupting, then how can a woman give birth without the aid of a midwife? End quote. This appears to be one of the only issues the grandparents disagree on. Quote, Child, look at me, she says softly. Respect your grandfather in all things, but know as well that midwives are a necessity. A more pleasing phrase we use for a midwife is she who collects the newborn. End quote. As absurd as it may sound to our Western ears, Chinese doctors were not allowed even to touch a woman's body. Insofar as they are involved in pregnancy and childbirth, it is only behind a screen set up between doctor and patient. A doctor, quote, might attend to a woman in labor, giving her herbs to speed the delivery and make the baby slippery, end quote. But that is all. Each of the young girls envies the other. Tan envies Mei Ling because she can actually be in the world and help women have safe deliveries. Mei Ling envies Tan both for her wealth and position and because she is able to train to be a doctor. Her grandmother, doctor, tells Tan, quote, I'm irritated with men. I'm lucky to love your grandfather, but most men, other doctors especially, don't like us to succeed. You must always show them respect and let them think they know more than you do, while understanding that you can achieve something they never can. You can actually help women. End quote. Both girls are successful in their studies and for different reasons are invited to attend women in the emperor's court. If they are successful, male doctors will be credited, and if they fail, their very lives may be at stake. Besides the history of Chinese medicine during this period, C gives the reader a long look at caste systems in China and the incredible history of foot binding among the higher castes and the ways in which higher caste girls are kept almost entirely out of the daily world of commerce. Tan continues to envy Mei Ling's ability to look at the real world rather than living a shuttered and sheltered life. After giving birth, the upper caste women do their month, attended by a doctor and perhaps the midwife who assisted in the delivery, watched over during the dangerous 4 weeks following birth. Quote, Grandmother and I visit Lady Hyong every morning to make sure she isn't affected by noxious dew, old blood and tissue that refuses to leave the child palace. We bring with us different warming medicines. Grandmother has been strict with Cook to make sure Lady Hyong is offered warming food only. Her blood is transformed into milk, and the baby suckles well. End quote. Western doctors have certainly had their dismal history of denigrating midwives and failing to progress in the treatment of pregnant women, even for a time refusing to release their patented grip on the use of forceps to aid in delivery. I love this book on so many levels. The story, the well-researched history, and the strong feminist bent the narrative takes. Quote, I hear the sound of voices. Miss Zhao, Lady Kua, and Poppy come into view and begin to cross the zigzag bridge to reach Mei Ling and me. For much of my life, I felt alone, but over the years, a circle of women came to love me, and I came to love each of these women in return. Who knows, really, how many days might be left for a woman such as myself, and what yet I might do when surrounded by so much beauty and love. End quote. I've been talking about Lisa See's historical novel, Lady Tan's Circle of Women, one of the many feminist-based novels she has written. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I am Patricia Kohlberg, reading today for Larry. That does it for our show today, except one last reminder that KBOO is only on the air because of support from listeners like you. Our community is blessed with one of the longest surviving, listener-supported, volunteer-run, non-commercial radio stations in the country. You can contribute, or better yet, become a member by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or clicking on Donate in your KBOO mobile app. You can also send us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all who have given so generously in the past. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Thanks to Moles, Matt Witt, Sharon Grant, Fran Michelle, Jan Hocken, and Larry Bolden for their contributions. And a special thanks to our guests, Kira Kelly and Claire Glenn. As always, the Moles would not be on the air without the hard work and support of KBOO staff. A big thanks to all of them. I'm going to leave you today with one more labor song, Out on Strike by the Rabble Rousers. Thanks for listening, and join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Until then, stay safe and stay active.